Let us imagine Amsterdam on August 2nd, 1675. Crowds streamed from across the city to the inauguration ceremony of what was called the Esnocha, the new Sephardic synagogue of the Portuguese Jews of the Netherlands. Unlike so many European synagogues that were created in ghettos or other specifically Jewish areas, and unlike London's Bevis Marks synagogue, which had been structured to be unobtrusively sitting in an alley, this synagogue was in public in one of the most prominent cities on earth. The inauguration of the synagogue was an event that attracted not only the Jews of the city, but also its non-Jews, including some talented artists from the community. One of them was a non-Jewish artist by the name of Romain de Hoogh, whose art about the occasion is absolutely astonishing. He created an image of the moment. This is the inauguration of a synagogue as seen by a non-Jew, and you see it on the screen. In understanding this image, I cite the historian Stephen Nadler in his amazing book, Rembrandt's Jews. Nadler writes, quote, "Among the invited attendees on August 2nd, 1675 was Romain de Hoogh, commissioned once again to capture on paper one of the community's milestones, this time a public one. He produced a number of etchings of the building and its inauguration ceremony. He was obviously impressed both by the structure and by the event. The massive synagogue complex, the prayer house of Jews, a builder's masterpiece, he called it, was, he noted, the glory of the Amstel and its Senate. The crowd that gathered that day," writes Nadler, "and the rituals they witnessed, their dress and easy mingling, the architecture of the building and the achievement it represented were for him a premier subject for admiration, for representation and admiration. He rendered the ceremony and surroundings in typically meticulous detail. The faces, the poses, the fashions, even the mood itself are expressly captured for posterity. The viewer can almost tell what is being talked about in the many conversations taking place. It is, above all, a picture of justified self-satisfaction and not just among the Jews," end quote. Nadler goes on to tell us that in some prints created of Romain de Hoogh's image, we were able to see not only an image of the Maid of Amsterdam, the symbol of the city, atop the picture, but also poems that were translated into several different languages, into Dutch, into Latin, into Spanish, into French, and into Hebrew. The point, of course, was that this was a community that had come into its own, a community that was proudly Jewish, but also was part of the larger world, part of the larger city, part of the Netherlands during the Dutch Golden Age. Also on this image created by de Hoogh was a picture of a Torah scroll as well as a motto, "Freedom of conscience is the strength of the Republic." What this means, ladies and gentlemen, as Nadler tells us, is that the creation of the Esnocha, the Portuguese synagogue of Amsterdam, was not merely an achievement for the Jewish community. It marked a moment for freedom of religion in the history of the world. Unlike synagogues throughout the world, this was one in which Jews were the worshipers, but non-Jews were often visitors. This is evident as well in another astonishing work of art from a prominent non-Jewish artist in the Netherlands, Emmanuel de Witt, who clearly stepped into the sanctuary and sketched it in order to produce this remarkable painting that you see on the screen. Let's look at it for a moment. If you look carefully, you will see that the Jews are discernible. They are the ones sitting in the sanctuary. They are wrapped in talitot, which go over their heads. Even though they're wearing hats, the talitot sit over their hats. And let me tell you, it's hard to keep talitot on your head while you have hats on. Those standing in the back, those not sitting, those not engaged in the service, those aren't Jews, ladies and gentlemen. Those are tourists. They're not wearing talitot. And as you could see in the painting, one of them has even brought a dog inside. You see as well, if you look carefully, one of the worshippers, clad in a talit, is standing up and his head is turning toward the back. He is looking at the visitors. He may be thinking, hey, why has that person brought a dog into the sanctuary? Or he's just saying, hey, visitors, welcome. Thus, what this community embodied, what this sanctuary inaugurated, was an age of incredible openness, of interaction between a Jewish community and a larger non-Jewish city, between a Jewish culture and a larger non-Jewish culture that was unparalleled in the history of any other Jewish community up to this point. And yet, the funny thing is, ladies and gentlemen, when so many people visit this synagogue, and I've heard this from those that give tour, that from someone who gives a tour of the synagogue, their interest, when they come, first and foremost, is not in openness, but in excommunication. Because I've been told so often synagogue leaders are asked when people visit the synagogue, where exactly in this sanctuary was Spinoza's excommunication performed? And of course, the answer to this question is nowhere, because this synagogue was built a good many years after Spinoza's excommunication. And interestingly, it's only when we keep the incredible openness of Amsterdam in mind that we can truly understand why the members of this Jewish community were so angry at Spinoza. And understanding this involves a journey through the history of this community, in which we will meet in our minds the fascinating figures, Jewish and non-Jewish, that are affiliated with the Spanish-Portuguese Jews of Amsterdam, the Jews that are memorialized to this day by the incredible edifice that is the Portuguese synagogue. My knowledge of this community, of the mother synagogue of my own synagogue, the Spanish-Portuguese Synagogue of New York, comes first and foremost from one of my favorite books, Rembrandt's Jews. The book, I must stress, is not first and foremost about Rembrandt, but rather about the Jews amongst whom he lived. Jews with a story, an origin story, unlike any other. Jews that interacted with Rembrandt and with other artists. Jews that commissioned paintings from Rembrandt and from other artists. And Jews that interacted with the larger world and maintained, in certain cases, a dual identity, being leaders within their own community and in the world at large. Understanding this synagogue and this community through images affiliated with them and linked to them allows us to bring this community again to life, to rediscover its story, a story that I will argue is very much relevant to our own time today. So let's briefly summarize the history of the community of Rembrandt's Jews, a history which is rightly understood wondrous. After living for 100 years as conversos in Portugal, as secret Jews, unable to perform the most elemental acts of Jewishness, such as circumcision, the early 1600s saw a beacon of religious freedom open in Amsterdam. And these Sephardim, at enormous sacrifice, gave up the lives they had known in Portugal, came to Amsterdam, took on circumcision often at an elderly age, and began, for the first time in generations, open Jewish observance, Judaic observance, as adults. Originally, among the Sephardic Jews of Amsterdam, there were three separate synagogues that ultimately united in 1639 into one synagogue community, known then as now as Kahal Kadosh Talmud Torah. In this merger of three synagogues, three rabbis were brought together with one another. The senior spiritual leader was named Shaul Halevi Mortera, who was the only one of the three who was raised from birth in open religious Judaism. He was also, as Nadler points out, the only one amongst them who was not actually a Portuguese Jew, but was an Ashkenazi. Now I know, ladies and gentlemen, what you're thinking. An Ashkenazi rabbi of a Spanish-Portuguese synagogue? That's just crazy. That can't actually happen. But it did. He was one of the three leaders. And then two other rabbinic figures that began their lives as conversos, Yitzchak Avoav de Fonseca, and the most famous of all of them today, Menashe ben Israel. Now you will, of course, be shocked, to learn that these three rabbis did not get along with each other. And Rabbi Mortera and Rabbi Avoav had a debate of massive proportions, a theological debate, a debate relating to whether it was possible for one to ultimately lose one's portion in the world to come entirely. a question that was, of course, fraught with enormous pathos and emotion because, as Nadler explained, many, many relatives of these Jews were still living very non-Jewish lives in Portugal and Spain. And so a debate emerged on this theological question of, can one entirely lose one's portion in the afterlife? Rabbi Mortara said yes, Rabbi Avohav said no. This was not a debate about policy, but a debate about theology. And it was resolved. Thus, Nadler tells us, and this is on the screen, the governors of the Amsterdam congregations, upset by so vehement a dispute between their rabbis, did not know what to do. So they asked the more experienced leaders and rabbis of the older Sephardic community in Venice to rule on the question. The Venetians' reply, while diplomatically expressed, was crystal clear. Mortara is right. Avohav is wrong. There is no indication that Avohav ever publicly retracted his views. As a practical matter, however, Mortara prevailed. And then, Nadler further tells us that this is what precipitated Rabbi Avohav to leave Amsterdam and to become the first rabbi in the New World, rabbi in Brazil. Quote, when the three congregations merged into one in 1639, Mortara was made the chief rabbi. Avohav was given the lowest rank, just below Menashe, although his salary was higher and his duties more extensive and prestigious than Menashe's. In 1642, Avohav left for Brazil to minister to the Amsterdam Jews who had settled in Recife during the Dutch occupation of that territory. His departure from Amsterdam was almost certainly the result of lingering tensions with Mortara. End quote. Thus, Rabbi Yitzchak Avohav de Fonseca, one of the three rabbis of the Portuguese Jewish community in Amsterdam, as a result of his fighting with one of the other rabbis, perhaps the greatest overreaction, one might say, to one rabbi fighting with another, he left and journeyed literally to the other side of the world to become the first rabbi in the Southern Hemisphere ever. And some of you may know, it was in 1654 that Portugal and the Inquisition moved into Brazil, leading that community to disband, with most of the Jews of Brazil, including Rabbi Avohav, sailing back to Amsterdam, and with 23 Jews leaving Brazil, sailing for Amsterdam, being captured by pirates, and then the pirates are being captured by a French ship, and the French captain telling those 23 Jews, it's nice that you want to go to Amsterdam, but I'm actually going to a place called New Amsterdam. And he brought those Jews to New Amsterdam, later known as New York, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is why I have a job today. It was only upon the death of Rabbi Mortara that Rabbi Avohav, Rabbi Yitzchak Avohav de Fonseca, became the supreme rabbi of that community. And it was he who, in the late 1660s, began to push for a new synagogue, arguing that the building in use on the that had been in use on the canal in the area of Amsterdam that was once known as the Houtgracht, on which Rembrandt lived, and that had become too small. And so the community rallied around Rabbi Avohav, and a famous architect, a non-Jewish architect in Amsterdam, was chosen by the name of Elias Bauman to design this new synagogue. And as Nadler notes, Elias Bauman collaborated in this design with a rabbi in the Amsterdam community by the name of Yehuda Leon, known more famously as Judah Templo, because he, like other Portuguese Jews, was obsessed with the temple in Jerusalem and created a model of Solomon's temple, which was visited by non-Jews from all over the world, including members of the Stuart family from England who had come to Amsterdam to raise money. And after the Stuart restoration in London, Yehuda Leon Judah Templo was invited, as you can see on the screen, to come to London and present a pamphlet, which was translated into English, on the temple. So you have a rabbi from Amsterdam invited in the 17th century to present on the temple in Jerusalem in London of that time period. Thus, the layout of the synagogue is attributed to this tag team of Elias Bauman and this amazing man, Yehuda Leon. But as all those who have ever visited the synagogue know, the most amazing aspect of the synagogue is its arch. The building itself is beautiful. If you look at an image on the screen, you could see what the synagogue looks like today. And we have a sense from the art of the period of how the synagogue, once joined by a bridge to the Ashkenazic synagogue on the other side of the river, an Ashkenazic synagogue that now no longer really exists, you could tell from looking at this image how incredible it must have seemed to have two prominent synagogues right in the center of one of the major cities of the Western world in the 1660s. So the synagogue itself is remarkable, and it's an astonishing testament to the way in which Dutch Jews were welcomed. But as Nadler writes, quote, "The pièce de résistance is, as well as it should be, the elaborately wrought ark of the Torah at its far end, donated by Moses Curiel, the Heichal," Heichal is what Sfaradim call the Aron, the ark. "The Heichal extends across the width of the nave and rises almost 25 feet. Its tripartite structure is divided by Ionic columns. The wings have triangular frontons, while the taller central portion is topped by an arch fronton that contains carved tablets of the law with gold lettering. Instead of a traditional curtain, the cabinets of the ark have doors. Their interiors are lined with red gilt leather, and they contain the number of Torah scrolls." End quote. This, then, is one of the most remarkable arks in the history of synagogues. But who is this man who endowed the ark, to whom Stephen Nadler refers? Who is Moses Curiel? It's important that we learn about him because it will give you a sense of the uniqueness of the lives that these Portuguese Jews in Amsterdam lived. Moses Curiel also bore another name entirely, which was Geronimo Nunez da Costa. Moses' father, Yaakov Curiel, whose name was also Duarte Nunez da Costa, had lived in Portugal as a descendant of a converso family and a secret Jew. He was a valued servant to the Portuguese king, but he decided to flee to Amsterdam to escape the Inquisition and start life anew in open Jewish observance. There in Amsterdam, he raised two children, including his oldest, Moses. I believe he began raising them in Germany. And then one, I think, went to Amsterdam. Amazingly, this very family that had preserved their Judaism under the nose of the royal house of Portugal proved so invaluable to the king that after they left Portugal with Yaakov Curiel in Germany and Moses Curiel, his son, in Amsterdam, they proved so invaluable to the king that they continued their work on behalf of the monarch. As the Jewish Virtual Library describes, it was actually, the story of the Curiel family is striking and gives us a sense of what these lives were like, how different they were from most Jews around the world. Let's read this biography. Quote, "The departure of the Curiel family from Portugal was the result of indiscreet correspondence between the Jewish branch of the family living in Italy and the Portuguese New Christian branch. Yaakov Curiel, alias Duarte Nunez da Costa, born in Murano in Lisbon, moved via Pisa and Florence to Amsterdam and later to Hamburg. Having made himself useful to members of the Royal House of Portugal in Hamburg, he was made Portuguese diplomatic representative. His elder son, Moses, Geronimo Nunez da Costa, died 1697, was Portuguese agent in Amsterdam, where he was prominent in the Sephardi community and represented his co-religionists in cases before the Dutch authorities. Yaakov's younger son, Solomon, Manuel Nunez da Costa, succeeded his father in Hamburg. The family held diplomatic positions in both cities until the late 18th century," end quote. So it's an amazing story. A man who had lived much of his life as Duarte Nunez da Costa embraces life as Yaakov and raises a son named Moses. And he had to leave and flee originally because word had gotten out from other members of his family that he was secretly living as a Jew. And so he had to flee for his life, but even when he flees, he still works for the king of Portugal. And his son Moses, even as he also takes on the appellation Geronimo, his business name, if you will, also becomes one of the Jewish leaders of Amsterdam while still serving the king of Portugal. He is like Mordechai in the Persian courts, Doresh Tov Li'amo V'Dover Shalom L'Chol Zaro, seeking the good of his brethren. But we know more about Moses Curiel than this, because we also know that Moses Curiel was one of the great supporters of artists and buyers of art in Amsterdam, encouraging artistic creations with Jewish themes. And here too we see another important uniqueness about this community. As Nadler notes, until this community, Jews did not buy art, Jews were nervous about images. Jews did not commission paintings. But having lived within the Catholic world for over 100 years, these Jews loved art. These Jews commissioned art. And Moses Curiel was one of the major art patrons of Amsterdam. Steven Nadler tells us, writing about the artist Romain de Hoogh, whose depiction of this of the Portuguese synagogue we saw at the beginning of this lecture. Nadler tells us that, quote, with a stipend provided by Hieronymus Nunez da Costa, the resident or commercial ambassador in Amsterdam for the King of Portugal, and better known within the Jewish community as Moses Curiel, de Hoogh produced 9 etchings purporting to show Solomon's temple in Jerusalem. End quote. The Curiels, then, were the leaders of the Jewish art world. And this is all the more entrancing. This is all the more entrancing because, ladies and gentlemen, there is a striking similarity between the Ark of today's Portuguese synagogue that Moses Curiel funded and a famous painting. As we look at the Ark, let us look again at the Ark and what makes it unique. We realize that unlike other sanctuaries, if you look at the image, you will see, unlike other sanctuaries, the luchot on this Ark have more, the tablets on this Ark have more than just the first 2 words of each of the 10 commandments. The letters are beautiful in gold on a dark surface. What's striking about that is that, as the Israeli art historian Shlomo Sabar has noted, that there is an incredible connection between that Ark with its tablets and the most famous artistic depiction of tablets with Hebrew on it ever created, and that is the painting that is behind me, the painting by Rembrandt of Moses holding the 2 tablets of the 10 commandments aloft. As the Israeli artist, as Shlomo Sabar has noted, Rembrandt's painting is, quote, strongly connected to the Sephardi community by a curious piece of evidence that has thus far escaped the attention of scholars, end quote. Because, as Sabar further argues, Rembrandt's tablets also has a dark surface with golden letters. And the letters look almost, as Sabar points out, almost identical to the ones on the Ark. Complete, as Sabar notes, with a matching elongated, beautiful bet on Lo Tignov to complete the margin, much as a sofer, a scribe, would create. So in other words, ladies and gentlemen, Rembrandt's tablets look very, very similar to the tablets that Moses Curiel commissioned that you could see in the current Portuguese synagogue. But here's the crazy part. This building, this Ark, was built by the Dutch Portuguese Sephardim in the late 1660s, a good 8 years after Rembrandt's death. So it can't be that Rembrandt would have walked into the synagogue and sketched the tablets of this Ark. And it doesn't make any sense to say that they would have based the Ark in Amsterdam off of Rembrandt, because Rembrandt at that time was not Rembrandt. He was a local dude who was a really good painter. So we face then what is an extraordinary artistic mystery. The tablets of Rembrandt are clearly obviously linked to the Aseret HaDibrot, to the 10 commandments of the current Portuguese synagogue, a synagogue which did not exist when Rembrandt's Moses was first created. The similarity between Rembrandt's Hebrew and that of the Portuguese Esnocha means that both of them must be based on some earlier source, a previous rendering of the Decalogue that was well known to the Sephardic community and well known to Rembrandt as well. But what rendering is this? Now, some of you may say, who cares? Why is it so interesting? And that would be a good answer if you were not hypothetically a rabbi who had read Rembrandt's Jews and became compulsively obsessed with Rembrandt and his connection to the Jewish community. And so, ladies and gentlemen, having read this book, Rembrandt's Jews, having become entranced with the relationship between the Jews of Amsterdam and Rembrandt, I set about solving this mystery. Again, we are looking for an earlier set of tablets that would have inspired both the current Ark created by Moses Curiel or commissioned by Moses Curiel in the Amsterdam synagogue, and Rembrandt's painting. What would that earlier source be? So the answer to this question, I think, lies with another painting associated with Rembrandt, dated 1650, slightly earlier than his Moses. This is assumed, and let's put it on the screen, this is assumed to be a depiction of Hannah and little Samuel in the tabernacle. And most art historians think it is a joint production of Rembrandt and his students. As you can see in this painting, there is also a Ten Commandments placed on tablets that are much larger and longer than the tablets in the Moses painting. These tabernacle tablets are similar to large, as art historians note, to large models of the tablets that were placed in Protestant churches throughout Holland, but with one important difference. The commandments on these large tablets are in Hebrew, and they are divided 5 and 5. 5 commandments on one side, 5 on the other, as Jews divided them, not 4 and 6, as Christians usually did. And when we study the Hebrew in the 1650 Hannah painting, especially the left or second tablet, you can see that its Hebrew parallels the Hebrew on the tablets of the 1659 Moses painting that is behind me. It seems obvious that both Rembrandt tablets in both paintings, as well as the tablets in the current Portuguese synagogue, are all modeled on the same earlier version of the Ten Commandments. And it would be logical, ladies and gentlemen, to assume that that version might have been found in the earlier Sephardic synagogue, the synagogue of the United Community of the Sephardim of Amsterdam, where they prayed before this new synagogue was created in the 1660s by Rabbi Avov de Fonseca. That was the earlier synagogue they prayed in when the three synagogues united into one in 1639. It was in that earlier synagogue where Spinoza had been excommunicated. And it was in that synagogue, that shul, where Rembrandt might have gotten a glimpse of the Luchot, of the tablets. What do we know about that synagogue that existed when Rembrandt was alive, that was really around the corner from where Rembrandt lived? Might there have been a depiction of the Ten Commandments in that edifice? One which was copied first by, one which might have been copied both by Rembrandt and by the Jews when they created a new synagogue. We have only one depiction of the interior of this older synagogue, and again, it is created amazingly by a Gentile artist, Jan van Huysen. And when we study it, we see that unlike in the current synagogue in Amsterdam, the ark did not have tablets on top. And yet, if you look very closely at Jan van Huysen's drawing, you notice, and let's put this on the screen, that the doors of the ark themselves have elongated panels that look a lot like tablets, indeed like the long tablets in Rembrandt's Hannah painting. Could this mean that the older Sephardi synagogue had its own Ten Commandments that Rembrandt would have copied? Again, you might say, we may never know, and you should just leave it as that. But again, if you are an obsessive rabbi who wants to really focus on this question, you will not leave the answer with that. I needed more information, so I wrote to the Jewish Museum in Amsterdam, asking if there were any other drawings of the interior of this older synagogue. I received the reply from a director of the Jewish Museum in Amsterdam that, quote, by the name of Miriam Knotter, that, quote, concerning images of the Houtgracht synagogue, that's the original synagogue, the etching you mentioned is unfortunately the only image known. However, a researcher, Timothy DePape, has been working on a 3D reconstruction based on the etching and other sources, which gives a nice image and may be useful for your purposes, end quote. So she sent me DePape's reconstruction of the original ark, and you can look at it on the screen. There you see two elongated tablet-like doors, but I saw no commandments on them. And so I decided to write this guy, Mr. DePape, who lived in Antwerp. And I wrote to him, quote, Miriam Knotter shared with me your wonderful recreation of the Talmud Torah synagogue. And then I added, I was hoping to find out if you had any information about what was on the doors of the Heichal, Ark. From the original etching, it seems that there may be depictions of the two long tablets of the law, one on each door. I'm not sure if this is correct or not, and I'm hoping that you may have some information on this. Thank you so much for your incredible work, Mayor Soloveitchik. Mr. DePlate replied, Dear Rabbi Soloveitchik, thank you very much for your email and kind words. The engraving is the only visual source I had for the reconstruction of the interior, apart from a few objects which still survive in the current Esnoga or the museum. The Heichal I created was very simple, a deliberate choice in order to minimize speculation. And he added, therefore, my model does not include any text or decorative carvings. However, he added, I do believe that the doors indeed represented two long, narrow tablets of the law. And he added, the Yasnoga, as the direct successor of the Talmud Torah synagogue, has two such inscribed tablets directly over the Heichal doors. In short, I do not have any additional concrete sources, but I agree with you that two tablets of the law were displayed, end quote. It was wonderful to have this hunch confirmed. Therefore, it would seem that the doors of the original 1639 ark in the Sephardic synagogue in Amsterdam contained 10 commandments in the form of long, thin tablets. And these 10 commandments were copied by Rembrandt's studio for his Hannah painting and for his Moses painting. And then the very same 10 commandments were copied in the construction of the tablets in the synagogue's successor, the current Portuguese synagogue. Which would mean that Rembrandt himself, in painting one of my favorite artistic creations, Moses holding the tablets of the law aloft, would have sketched it straight off the original Sephardic synagogue. Could this be? Could a non-Jewish artist have walked straight into the synagogue? Could he and his students have walked into the sanctuary and sat close enough to sketch the Aseret HaDibrot, the Ten Commandments, that we will read this Wednesday? Of course he could have, because as we saw from the paintings of the later Spanish synagogue, non-Jews went into the synagogue all the time. And as Stephen Nadler tells us, when the Jewish community of the Sephardim was created in Amsterdam, becoming really the first major open integrated Jewish community in Europe, there were non-Jews who came to Amsterdam from places that did not have Jewish communities like that, and that was where they went on Saturday. It was like a tourist spot. You're going to go see something you don't usually get to see. Jews and their ways. Thus, Stephen Nadler writes, quote, they came from abroad. For British tourists of Amsterdam, attending the synagogue on the Houtgracht was the thing to do. And as we can learn from accounts that Nadler brings us, these non-Jews visiting the synagogue on Shabbat morning, ladies and gentlemen, made the most obvious rookie mistake. They came to shul on time. Obviously, rookie mistake. Thus, we are told by Nadler about a British person, Sir William Breton, who attended Shabbat morning services from 9 to half 12, and noted as well that they all have white mantles of a kind of linen, but short. These they wear over their hats, which they never put off during all their being in church, end quote. Which means, ladies and gentlemen, in other words, that the Jews of Amsterdam, they didn't wear yarmulkes. Outside in the street, they would dress exactly as anyone else did, which means they needed to cover their heads, and so they wore hats. This visitor, William Breton, also noted how shocked he was by the way Jews talk during services. And I know all of you listening are shocked as well. Or as he put it, quote, here in this congregation, no good order, no great zeal and devotion here appearing. Much time spent singing and in talking. Nadler further tells us how this was not merely a tourist site. The synagogues of the Dutch Sephardim would be visited by royalty, who even in one stark example came as schnorrers to the synagogue. As he writes, quote, the visit of visits, however, and the community's proudest moment before the completion of the 1675 synagogue occurred in May 22nd, 1642, when royalty came to the Houtgracht looking for a handout. The 11-year-old daughter of King Charles and Queen Henrietta Maria of England, Princess Mary, was set to wed 13-year-old Prince William II, the son of Prince Frederick Hendrik, Stadtholder of Holland, and his wife Amalia van Solms. This was, as so many royal marriages of the time, a political arrangement, an attempt to pacify the relationship between the House of Orange and the House of Stuart, end quote. And she visited the synagogue to raise money. They visited the synagogue, the Stuarts, to raise money from Dutch Jews. Nadler further tells us that Menashe ben Israel wrote that, quote, ordinarily the synagogues are full of Christians, what with great attention stand considering and weighing all the Jews' actions and motions, end quote. Which means this community, Rembrandt's Jews, was unlike any other community on earth. It was a community where Shabbat and Shul was filled with Jews and non-Jews, Jews sitting and praying, non-Jews standing and observing, entranced, fascinated. 17th century interaction between Jewish and non-Jewish worlds, artistically, culturally and even religiously, the likes of which you wouldn't find anywhere else in the 17th century. And by and large, with the exception of the Jews of early America, which you would not find in the 18th century in Europe, or even in the 19th century. Or if I could put it slightly differently, this Moses painting means that Rembrandt, I think, or at least his students, would have gone straight into the Sephardic shul and sketched the Ten Commandments, the very original shul where Spinoza was excommunicated, or to put it slightly differently, the source of the most Jewish painting in the history of Western art is a synagogue in which Rembrandt was more welcome than Spinoza. And this, in turn, tells us something about Spinoza and his excommunication at the hands of the members of this community. Because what we've learned thus far is two aspects of these Sephardim that set them apart from virtually every other Jewish community on earth. First, they experienced incredible freedom, openness that allowed them to practice their faith in a way unavailable to almost any Jew anywhere. And second, therefore, that they would have had a great sense of what they gave up in order to come here, and the trials and tribulations that their ancestors in Spain and Portugal had underwent at the hands of the Inquisition. The symbol of this community, which you can still see on the carpet of the library in the synagogue complex today, was a phoenix rising from the ashes. The flames, of course, represent the fires of the Inquisition and of Torquemada, which meant that the Jews of Amsterdam would have had a very deep sense of how grateful they ought to be that God had providentially given them this opportunity for religious freedom, and therefore what a responsibility they had to utilize that freedom to live openly as Jews. And this brings us to Spinoza. In an interesting essay about Sephardic Jewry in Amsterdam, Dr. Alan Corray reflects on why the response to Spinoza was so strong. The answer that one sees most often is that Spinoza's heterodox views were very well known, and this made the Jews of Amsterdam nervous that they might be held responsible by Christians for Spinoza's own doubting of the revelatory nature of the Torah. But Dr. Corray, himself a descendant of these Portuguese Jews, argues that this interpretation, while plausible, is insufficient, because he actually notes that Portuguese Jews were very open about what their own beliefs were, and they would not have been that nervous, he insists, about being affiliated with what Spinoza says. Rather, Dr. Corray argues that we have to understand the sacrifice that lay at the heart of this community. They are Jews who had descended from Jews who had been burnt at the stake for being secret Jews. And these Jews in Amsterdam had given up all that Portugal had offered them culturally and economically to build religious life anew, often undergoing circumcision as adults in order to embrace the faith of their fathers. Now Spinoza suddenly had been arguing that all this was in vain because Judaism, in Spinoza's view, was incorrect in its central tenets. This was seen by the Jews of Amsterdam as an assault on the sacrifices of the community and their families, because if Spinoza was right, then the Jews from which they descended had been burnt at the stake in vain, and they themselves had been circumcised and given up so much in vain. The notion that a member of their community would take the freedom that Providence had bestowed and would use that freedom to openly reject and intellectually attack all that their community had held dear reflected in this community's eyes a lack of hakarat hatov, a lack of recognition of the gift that Providence had handed them, that God had given them. Dr. Corray puts it this way, quote, "What bothered the authorities about Spinoza and his like was something else, I feel. Spinoza belonged to a family who had only recently achieved the freedom of Amsterdam. They had come from parts of the world where at this very time crypto-Jews were dying for their beliefs. If Spinoza was right, the deaths of the martyrs was totally meaningless." And Corray adds that when it came to Spinoza, quote, "to this crime of treachery to the memory of the martyrs, he added that no lesser crime of ingratitude, given the freedom of Amsterdam to practice his Judaism, he promptly discards it. This combination of treachery and ingratitude is, to my mind, the true scandal of Spinoza and his companions in the eyes of his contemporaries," end quote. In other words, for the Sfaradim of Amsterdam, freedom brought responsibility. Responsibility to remember those who had died for Judaism in the past, Jews from whom they descended, Jews who had died at the stake, as well as the responsibility to utilize that freedom, to live openly as Jews, and to contribute as Jews to the larger society. It is therefore no coincidence that those that were continuing the traditions of the Spanish-Portuguese Jews in the 17th century in New York seized so eagerly the opportunity of political equality to live openly as Jews and as Americans. It's with this in mind, ladies and gentlemen, with all that we have discussed about the Jews of Amsterdam in mind, that we can return back to Rembrandt's Moses and ponder all that is fascinating about it. Simon Schama notices an interesting aesthetic element in the painting. The canvas, he writes, presents us with a Mount Sinai and a Moses that is virtually a tawny, what he calls a tawny brown monochrome, with, quote, the figure of the prophet coarsely clad and rough cast, as though extruded from the stone itself, end quote. And if we think about this, we realize how fitting this is. As I've discussed in my essays about this painting, Rembrandt here is giving us, I think, not as is often assumed, the shattering of the first set of tablets during the sin of the golden calf. After all, Moses does not look angry. Rather, Moses is giving us the second set of tablets, the symbol of the covenant that was once shattered and had been restored. This Simon Schama also suggests, and it's fascinating because as a careful reader of the Bible like Rembrandt would have noticed, while the first set of tablets were given directly by God, the second set were carved by Moses, extruded by Moses, some might say, from the stone itself, just as Simon Schama describes the tawny monochrome Moses as extruding from the stone itself. What Rembrandt is giving us here, in other words, is the capacity of people to rebuild, to recarve, to recreate a covenant after that covenant had been shattered. How fitting it is then, ladies and gentlemen, that these tablets of Rembrandt were modeled on a synagogue which served as the spiritual home for Sephardic Jews whose own ancestral community had been shattered in Spain and Portugal, and who in Rembrandt's Amsterdam ensured that through human devotion, their Jewish covenant was restored. These were Jews who had not had a shul, a community of Jewish life for over a century, and they created it all anew. It was a community that, like the tablets, had been shattered, but like the tablets, had been reforged anew. So with this in mind, that we can, in conclusion, approach the theological challenge that occurred in this community right after Rembrandt died, as right before the current synagogue was created. In the 1660s, a man by the name of Shabtai Tzvi announced to the Jewish world that he was the guaranteed Messiah, the Redeemer of Israel. Many Jews throughout the world embraced him as the Messiah, but perhaps above all in Amsterdam. Thus Nadler tells us that, quote, the members of the community now led by the mystically inclined Chief Rabbi Avov threw all caution to the wind as they abandoned themselves to joyful anticipation of their return to Jerusalem. Merchants neglected their businesses. Everyday affairs were disrupted. And ordinary religious observance was suspended. Many Amsterdam Jews dropped all mundane matters and arranged immediately to travel to the Holy Land. Among them was Moses Curiel, Romain de Hoogh's patron, end quote. So you have to imagine Moses Curiel, this is before the new synagogue was created, a man who had undergone secret Judaism and then returned to Judaism, who had seen his own community rise phoenix-like from the ashes. Could he not think that this was all a preliminary step to the eschatological era? When a false Messiah arrived, the Jews of Amsterdam fell for him hook, line, and sinker. And to this day, when one visits the Eitz Chaim Library, part of the Dutch synagogue complex, you can see, and this is our next image, one can see the proclamation from the community that declares Shabtai Tzvi to be the Messiah. Then, of course, Shabtai Tzvi converted to Islam, and world Jewry in general, and Amsterdam Jewry in particular, realized that they had been taken in by one of the most terrible con men in Jewish history. This is what happened in the mid-1660s. It's easy, ladies and gentlemen, for us to judge these Jews, but let's look at it from their perspective. This was a community that had miraculously recreated itself after a traumatic expulsion out of Spain. It had defeated the Inquisition. Since 1492, since the expulsion, Sephardic thinkers had wondered why these traumas were occurring, and many interpreted them messianically. So they fell for the Messiah, and they were shown to be terribly, embarrassingly wrong. What would you expect this Jewish community to do? You might think that this might set back all of their endeavors to re-embrace the Judaism of their forefathers, but it did not. They did not allow this disaster to destroy Judaism in Amsterdam and the community they had built. Instead, it was precisely right after the dashing of their hopes and the exposure of Shabtai Tzvi that Rabbi Avohov said, let's build this new great synagogue. And it was right after Moses Curiel had planned to move to the Holy Land to embrace the false Messiah that Moses Curiel said, I will support the creation of this new magnificent ark, a symbol of the eternal covenant that is the giving of the Torah. Thus, if you visit the synagogue as I have just in the last 2 weeks, and you look at the opening door of the congregation, you will see that it features the verse, Avo el Beitecha, I will come into your house. And if you look carefully, and we'll put this on the screen, as Nadler points out in his book, the dots begin on the letter Bet. There are dots on the last bet, and when you join it to the letters before, you get Avohav, giving a tribute to the rabbi who had gone through so much, a rabbi who had been raised as an open Christian and a secret Jew, a rabbi who had been circumcised as an adult, a rabbi who had traveled all the way to Brazil to be a rabbi, and then a rabbi who had seen Portugal come to Brazil, and he had to flee back to Amsterdam. A rabbi who had then fallen for a false Messiah, and a rabbi who then said, after all these shatterings, we recarve the tablets of the Torah anew. And so he created a new synagogue, and upon those tablets he celebrated the Torah, modeled on the previous synagogue, tablets paralleled by Rembrandt, tablets that teach us about the ability of the Jewish people to build after undergoing shattering. My favorite story about this painting and about Rembrandt and Rembrandt's Jews involves my own obsessive preparation for a talk on the subject at a conference and my obsessive research about this painting and the synagogue from which it was derived. On my way to Israel once for a bar mitzvah, I decided to stop in Berlin where this painting hangs and actually take a look at it. So I went to the museum, looked at it, studied the painting, and then went right back to the airport in Berlin for the flight to Israel. Probably because I had a one-way ticket to Tel Aviv, I was taken aside by Israeli security. Israeli security agents said to me, English, Hebrew, and I said, Mashat Madifa, whichever you prefer, showing off. She was not impressed. And she said to me in Hebrew, are you from Berlin? And I said, no, I'm from New York. So she said to me, what do you do in New York? And I said, Ani mishamesh karav shel bet knesset sfaradit portugeset in New York. I work as the rabbi of the Spanish Portuguese synagogue in New York. So she says to me, do you speak Portuguese? I said, nope, not one word. And now she's thinking, now this is like the worst cover story that anyone's come up with. This Ashkenazi Jew, rabbi of a Spanish Portuguese community, doesn't speak Spanish, doesn't speak Portuguese. This is clearly all a lie. So then she says to me, suspiciously, Why did you come to Berlin? How long were you in Berlin? I said, a couple hours, now I'm going. So she says, why did you come to Berlin? I said, I came to see a Rembrandt. So she says, you came to Berlin just to see a Rembrandt? So I take out an image, and I begin describing what I've told all of you today in this lecture. I said, Zalorak Rembrandt. I said, Moshe Rabbeinu. It's not just Rembrandt, it's Moshe. And I started explaining, first tablet, second tablet. And she said to me in Hebrew, just go back in line. Maybe I may be a terrorist, but she is not going to listen to a Dvar Torah. And as I prepared to board the plane, I thought to myself, maybe she didn't want to hear my Dvar Torah about the first tablets and the second tablets. But is there any greater testimony to the fact of the incredible Jewish capacity to rebuild after shattering, a capacity to which this painting testifies and to which its mysterious link to a Jewish community teaches us. Is there any greater testimony to this capacity than the fact that I am about to board an El Al plane in Germany to travel to the land of Israel? We find ourselves, ladies and gentlemen, in a time when the state of Israel and when the world Jewish community experienced a terrible shattering. But the past 8 months have been not only some of the most trying in recent memory, but also some of the most inspiring, because we have seen, as we just saw in this past week, and what is now known as Operation Arnon, the capacity of Jews to come back after a shattering has occurred, to rededicate themselves in love to their fellow Jews and to Jewish ideas and Jewish life and to Jewish faith. That is ultimately what the story of Rembrandt's Jews is all about. That is ultimately what the secret at the heart of Rembrandt's painting of Moses is all about. And so as we study this and as we prepare to read the Ten Commandments that Moses, that Rembrandt so beautifully gives us, the same Ten Commandments that are so beautifully depicted on the Portuguese synagogue of Amsterdam, as we prepare to read these Ten Commandments aloud, we think about the story of the tablets of the Ten Commandments. We celebrate the eternal resiliency and endurance of the Jewish people. And as we mark the greatest miracle in Jewish history, the Sinai Revelation, we pray to God for the restoration of Jews to their homes and to their families. And please God for many more miracles yet to come. Thank you very much.